First case for argument this morning is Waterloo Furniture v. Hayworth Incorporated. Mr. Dennerlein.
Good morning. May it please the Court. In December 1992, my client Waterloo and Hayworth entered into a license agreement to settle a dispute that actually was pending in this district court below regarding a patent called the 798 patent. That agreement, not unlike many patent licenses, included what's called an MFN, or Most Favored Nations Clause, about having more favorable rates applied to my client if that happens. Later in 1998, Hayworth in fact sued a company called SoftView and for patent infringement under the same patent. For whatever reason, that case was ultimately settled in the year 2004 after the patent had expired, and it was settled pursuant to an agreement and there was a dismissal. The district court below erred in granting summary judgment, denying my client access to even see that agreement because, first of all, the district court did not even discuss the MFN notice provision or analyze it. And that provision says that in the event that Hayworth enters into any license agreement under the 798 patent with any direct competitor of Waterloo, then Hayworth shall provide written notice of such agreement and the terms thereof to Waterloo within 30 days following the execution thereof. What the district court did below is, rather than analyzing that language, is simply applied the term provision in Section 3-4 and said that while I look at the term provision, it says the agreement continues until the patent expires, and I'm done. I'm not going to look any further necessarily, not even look at the MFN notice provision, although she didn't explicitly say that.
Didn't the MFN notice provision also contain that limiting language about during the term of this agreement?
That it's the same section, but not the language that deals with notice. So yes and no. The language you're referring to, Your Honor, is at the beginning of that sentence, beginning of that paragraph, rather, that says that the grant, if the grant occurs during the term of this agreement, meaning the term of the agreement that has the obligations, then those terms are compared, meaning the term. Let me back up and explain more simply. There's a distinction between the language in the provision that says grant versus enters into. If you look at the notice provision, and we pointed this out in our brief, the notice provision has the language that says, in the event that Hayworth enters into any license agreement, that's entering into an agreement. That's what triggers the notice provision, and that was what it was at issue below. The comparison obligation, which is, okay, now that I see the agreement, what do I do with it? Now I've got to compare either an apple to an apple or an orange to an orange and see if this agreement is more favorable than ours. That's in the beginning of the clause of 7-2, which says if during the term of this agreement Hayworth grants a license. There's a distinction between entering into an agreement, which is any agreement. If you enter into one that's a license, we get to see it. Then we determine, was the grant during the term of our agreement? So they use two different words. They use entering into an agreement for the notice. Was any agreement entered into that licensed the patent? Then there's the comparison obligation, which we never got to yet, which uses the language grant. Grants can occur retroactively. And in fact, in the very agreement that's at issue in our case that creates the obligation, its grant went back to October 1992, a couple of months before the agreement was executed. And in fact, we put in the record other agreements that Hayworth had entered into under this same patent, where I think one for Rubbermaid, the actual grant went back several months before the agreement was executed. So there's a distinction in the provision between the notice obligation, which simply says broadly, if you enter into any license agreement, you get to see it. Then you go and decide whether you should you go to the comparison obligation and you compare the two and say, well, what's the period of the grant? Do they overlap? Do they overlap with your agreement? If so, then let's compare it and see if this later licensee got a better deal.
That construction of the notice provision means that the notice provision is perpetual, then.
No,
it's not. At least as I understand your argument.
It's not, Your Honor. And the reason it's not perpetual is we all know you have to look at agreements in the context of the law. Well, under patent law, you cannot pursue a claim for patent infringement more than 6 years beyond the expiration of the patent. So we know for sure that there can be no agreement licensing the 798 patent more than 6 years after it expires. So the parties know for sure when the last day is that Hayworth could have ever licensed the 798 patent. So it's not perpetual. It ends when they no longer are able to license the patent, which is 6 years after it expires. Because as we set forth in the case law, in the brief, the case clearly recognizes that you can sue on a patent after it expires. And if you can sue on a patent after it expires, you certainly can enter into an agreement to waive suit to license it. And we cite cases discussing retroactive license and so forth, and there's a Supreme Court case, the Talking Pictures, and I think also the DeForest Radio case, which clearly state that a license is nothing more than a waiver of the right to sue. So if you have a right to sue for 6 years after a patent expires, you certainly can license it after it expires. And there are Federal Circuit cases that deal with patent law that explicitly recognize the concept of retroactive licenses. So, but we've never seen the language of the soft view agreement that my client sought. But we reasonably inferred that it was a license agreement because it resolved a patent infringement dispute. It resolved it by agreement, and it resulted in that dispute being dismissed. Based on the case law, it's reasonable to infer that was a form of patent license because a patent license can be nothing more than a waiver of the right to sue, which clearly Hayworth did when they went further pursuing their infringement case in New York and entered into an agreement with SoftView in sometime on or before March of 2004. So to address your point, that's how I would address that. The other reason there was error below is because when you look at the whole agreement, which you're required to do under Michigan law, which applies here, the parties, and I'll cite one Michigan case or quote one Michigan case here, which says that it is a cardinal rule in the construction of contracts that the intention of the parties is to be inquired into, and if not forbidden by law, is to be effectuated. Too much regard is not to be had to the proper and exact significance of words and sentences so as to prevent the simple intention of the parties from taking effect. This is really important here because the parties wrote into their agreement, in fact, into the MFN provision, their express intent as to what they meant they wanted this provision to mean and how it should apply. They said, quote, "The intent of Hayworth and Waterloo is to provide that Waterloo is treated no less favorably than direct competitors of Waterloo in regard to licensing of the 798 patent." They said that right in the agreement. So if we have a situation, which my client believes happened here, where Hayworth licensed the patent after the patent expired, but nonetheless a license, why should we treat that any differently than if they had licensed it before the patent expired? To do so would contradict the party's intent, which is that we want to make sure you're not treated any less favorably. Now, we won't know that until we actually see the agreement, but certainly the only way you can effectuate that intent is to follow the MFN notice obligation, which also itself clearly says if you enter into any license agreement, we get to see it. So you have to be able to see the agreement to analyze it, and then you analyze it to see if those terms are more favorable, and if they are, then the express intent of the parties is that my client gets the benefit of those more favorable terms. Now, there's specific language that covers the comparison obligation, but the point being is that the court below, if you were to look at this, well, what's a Michigan court going to do here? Well, the Michigan Supreme Court has said, look to the party's intent. It's not a very uncommon principle of contract law, but actually Michigan is a little bit more aggressive here. Look to the party's intent, and if it's expressly stated, you follow that. Here, it's expressly stated. Couldn't be clearer. So I think that's another reason that the court committed error below. Additional reasons are that the court relied on, the court analyzed a section 5-6, which said that in any case, Waterloo's obligation to pay royalties shall cease as of the day of the 798 patent expires. What we had argued below was that because you have a provision that says when an obligation expires upon the expiration of the patent, it can't be that the general term provision clearly indicates that all obligations cease upon the expiration of the patent. Otherwise, you wouldn't need this section 5-6. It would be rendered superfluous. The district court explained that away by saying that, well, that was just to clarify. That section 5-6 was just to clarify when things ceased. And our response is, well, if the termination provision in 3-4 is so clear, why do you need a clarification in 5-6? The reason it's there is because reading the contract as a whole, it's apparent that when the contract term provision 3-4 ended pursuant to the expiration of the patent, that didn't necessarily mean that all obligations ceased, and certainly not the MFN obligation.
Mr. Dennerlein, what obligations would you say did apply or cease with 3-4? Why is 3-4 there?
I think 3-4 is there because it's very common in patent license agreements to make sure that the license extends at least through the entire period of the patent. So what that agreement, that provision says is that, quote, this agreement shall be effective only when executed by both parties and shall continue for the full term of said license patent unless earlier terminated, et cetera. So it doesn't actually say, like other cases we cited, where even there they found obligations to continue. It doesn't actually say the agreement terminates and everything terminates upon the expiration of the patent. It actually just says that the agreement shall continue through the term of the patent, which is...
Wait a minute. You lost me. I'm not sure I understand the difference between the first part of your thought and the latter part. I mean, you want to just run that by me one more time?
Sure. It comes down as simple as this, is that my only point was this, which is that the 3-4 itself, for what it's worth, doesn't explicitly say everything terminates when the 798 patent expires. There are provisions, for at least provision 5-6, which does explicitly say that. So I posit that the general term provision, if you look at it just by itself with blinders, is the wrong way to look at the contract, because you've got to look at it as a whole. And if you just look at that one provision, I think it misconstrues the overall intent of the parties.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Surely. Mr. Grossman.
May it please the Court, Paul Grossman for Defendant Appellee Hayworth, Inc. We respectfully submit that summary judgment was appropriately granted in this case. First, for the reasons set forth in the District Court's opinion, namely that the Hayworth-Waterloo license agreement expired by its own terms on October 14, 2003, the same day the 798 patent term expired. Since the settlement agreement with Sofi wasn't entered into until March of 2004, it can't possibly implicate any terms in the Waterloo agreement because that agreement had expired. Second, the terms and the language of this particular most favored nations provision do not implicate the Sofi settlement agreement. First, the very language of that provision states that it applies only to a license granted during the term of the agreement. Since the agreement expired on October 14, 2003, so too did the Most Favored Nations provision. And second, the term of the Most Favored provision states very clearly that it only applies if Hayworth grants a license to thereafter make, use, or sell the patented product. In March of 2004, Hayworth could not possibly grant a license to thereafter make, use, or sell the patented product. The patent had expired. Hayworth no longer had any ownership interest in the patent, and Hayworth didn't have anything that it could license to a third party. Hence, this provision, the Most Favored Nation provision, or excuse me, this part of the Most Favored Nations provision could not possibly apply to that settlement with Sofia. What this means is, even if you accept Waterloo's claim that there is such a thing as a retroactive license, which we certainly do not, and the cases that Mr. Dennerlein relies on have absolutely nothing to do with the Most Favored Nations provision or the concept of a retroactive license in the way he's trying to apply that. But even if you do accept that for a moment, it doesn't apply to this particular Most Favored Nations provision. This particular Most Favored Nations provision is only discussing the prospective licensing of the 798 patent. It only applies in the event that Hayworth grants a license to thereafter make, use, or sell the patented product. And a third reason why we assert that summary judgment was appropriately granted is that nearly every single case that has considered this exact issue, that is, whether a Most Favored Nations provision can apply to the settlement of past infringement, has found, correctly we believe, that a Most Favored Nations provision is not implicated by such a settlement. turning first then to the reasons the district court gave for granting summary judgment, it's clear under Michigan law that any unambiguous contract can be interpreted as a matter of law. Here, under the Section 3 is entitled Grant and Term. And the term says, this agreement shall be effective only when executed by both parties and shall continue for the full term of said license patent, unless the agreement is terminated earlier. And we respectfully submit that is as bad an unambiguous a statement as the term of the contract that you can have. Mr. Dennerlein argues that, I think, that that provision doesn't specifically state that it terminates on the date that the 798 patent terminates. But numerous courts have considered this. We cited several in our brief, that this exact language is in fact used in many, many patent licenses to indicate that that is the end of the license. Mr. Dennerlein also argues that the intent clause in the most favored nations provision is an indication of that the parties intended that Hayworth and Waterloo be treated favorably in all that Waterloo be treated favorably compared to its direct competitors in all instances. But that's not what that provision says. What that provision says is the intent of Hayworth and Waterloo is to provide that Waterloo is treated no less favorably than direct competitors of Waterloo in regard to licensing the 798 patent. That's Mr. Dennerlein would conveniently forget the last few sentences. It's in regard to licensing the 798 patent. It says nothing about settling past infringement. And in this particular case, what we have here is a situation where Sofi and Hayworth settled a case dealing with past infringement. This is not a license, hence that intent provision is not even implicated. Furthermore, as we explained in our brief, we don't believe that that particular provision deals with this, the sort of general intent of Hayworth and Waterloo in all cases. It deals with the explanation it further explains what's going on in the second sentence, the most favored nations provision, which is the situation in which Hayworth would license the patent to a direct competitor of Waterloo and receive some form of unique non-monetary compensation. If, for instance, this competitor were to manufacture products for Hayworth or something along those lines, in that case, it would be impossible for Waterloo to match that particular unique provision. And what the parties then go on to say is, in that event, Waterloo would be permitted to substitute some unique form of substantial equivalent of that unique form of compensation. And then the general intent there is that the parties, that Waterloo will be treated just as favorably as it drives competitors. It doesn't deal with a situation in which it wasn't meant to expand upon the first sentence of the Most Fair Nations provision, which is that in the event that Hayworth grants a license during the term of the agreement, Waterloo would be permitted to match those terms. Mr. Dennerlein also discusses Section 5-6 of the Waterloo Agreement, which deals with that language. It says, in any case, Waterloo's obligation to pay royalties shall cease as of the day that the 798 patent expires. Again, as the district court held, Section 5-5, immediately before that provision, states very clearly that or discusses the situations in which Waterloo's obligations to pay a royalty may prematurely end. If, for example, a court had held that the 798 patent was invalid, or if a court had construed the 798 patent in such a way that Waterloo's products were excluded from it. It then goes on to explain, in any case, that Waterloo's obligations would not extend beyond the life of the patent. The very use of the words in any case are an indication that it's simply explaining or refining what was said in 5-5. To turn to Waterloo's contention that there's such a thing as a retroactive license or that what Hayworth could have granted here is a retroactive license, we respectfully submit that Waterloo is making a very fundamental mistake here. They're taking some Supreme Court cases and some Federal Circuit cases that stand for the proposition that a license can sometimes be nothing more than a promise not to sue. And they're flipping it. They're turning it on its head, and they're saying a promise not to sue is necessarily a license. But that's just not true. While if we can just think of a very simple hypothetical and say a battery case, if we have a situation where Mr. Jones punches Mr. Smith, then Mr. Smith would have a claim against Mr. Jones for battery. If Mr. Smith accepts some money and promises not to sue Mr. Jones for his battery, what we have there is a settlement. I don't believe anybody would refer to that as a license or argue, as Mr. Dennerline does now, that Mr. Smith's conduct in punching, or that Mr. Jones' conduct in punching Mr. Smith was in fact licensed. Patent infringement is exactly the same thing as battery. It's a tort. And what we have here is a situation where Hayworth and Softview settled a tort claim. It was impossible for them to give a license because the patent had expired. Hence, the most favored nations provision cannot be implicated. And it's for this reason, and in this reasoning, at the vast majority of cases that we cite in our brief, the Novamont case out of the Second Circuit, the Searle case, the Wang case, the Raytheon case from the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, all the cases that have considered this issue have held that a most favored nations provision is not implicated by a settlement of past infringement. A license, by its very nature, is prospective. You have some property, you're giving the person the right to use that property in the future. That's what a license is. The Ethicon case cited by Mr. Dennerline in his reply brief stands for that exact proposition. The only case that Mr. Dennerline has found in his brief that he relies upon is the Shatterproof Glass case. Now, the Shatterproof Glass case, we respectfully submit, is making exactly the same mistake or leap in logic that Mr. Dennerline is making. It relies on a Supreme Court case, the DeForest case, which stood for the basic proposition that the basic proposition that a patent holder who uses some language or undertakes some conduct that would allow an accused infringer to believe that his activity was licensed has in fact licensed the patent. That makes perfect sense, and we wouldn't dispute that. Shatterproof Glass then takes that logic and uses it to apply it to a situation in which a patent holder has both licensed its patent going forward and settled it going past. But again, the Shatterproof Glass case does not successfully consider the difference between a license and a settlement. This one, I have nothing further. If the court has no questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grossman. Mr. Dennerline?
Well, I think that the basic problem here is that you can license an expired patent. I mean,
do you have a case that says that?
Pardon?
Do you have a case that says that?
That you can license?
Where the license comes into being when the settlement deals with a patent that's already expired, Mr. Dennerline. Not a settlement where there's still life in the patent.
We cite a case in our brief. I believe it's a Hercules case from the Federal Circuit that discusses the concept that when we remand the case below, the district court's going to discuss the issue of an implied retroactive license. In that situation, the patent had already...
What's the factual setting there? Are we dealing with an attempt, as we would have it here, to see whether a license can come into being after the period of the patent had expired? I know courts are split on the other side of when the patent still has life, but how similar is the Hercules case to factually in this setting? I don't mean obviously the patent.
Well, I'm only citing it for the principle of law it discusses. I don't think factually it's similar in a sense there was an expired patent.
The setting of the settlement and potential license that would flow from it seems to me, at least our research hasn't produced a case. I'm not saying it shouldn't, but that where the patent had expired and then the settlement permitted a license to flow from it?
To answer that specific question, I can't do it now. I'd have to re-review the cases to know for sure, but I will say this. I don't think it makes a difference whether there's a case that actually has done that and cited or not.
It's a case of first impression. I mean,
I think it happens quite a bit, actually, but the point is that you clearly have rights to patent after it expires. We cite cases that say that in our brief.
I understand.
You clearly can waive your right to sue after a patent expires. The Supreme Court in DeForest, for example, clearly said that a patent license can be no more than the waiver of right to sue, which makes sense because your only right is the right to stop people or to get damages under a patent.
Well, I don't want to speak so much about the right to sue and in the sense of prospective monetary settlement. I'm just wondering whether an additional license can flow as part of that settlement as opposed to just a monetary disbursement.
I'm not sure I follow, but I mean a license can be no more than a lump sum payment to the patent holder by the...
That would you seek here, just one-time lump sum payment?
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen the agreement. That's the whole problem here. Is that we're not, I think one of the problems is we're leaping to the comparison obligation. We haven't gotten there yet. We're simply saying we'd like to see the agreement. And there's a lot of smoke here, and usually where there's smoke, there's fire. If there wasn't really an issue here, we think we would...
Have a case on that?
No, but I don't think we need one. So I think we're jumping the gun here because we're really talking about the notice obligation. I think if you look at the agreement as a whole, that's crystal clear. We should at least be able to see the agreement. And then we can answer the questions such as you raised. Thank you, Your Honor.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.